Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hey, look, the Dow hit 16,000. What? You wanted more than that? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 18th of November. Great, as always, to have you with us. All right, here you go. 16,030.28. That's the new intraday record high for the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And there was much rejoicing at the corner of Wall Street and Broad about that today, even though the blue chips did slip at the close just a tad. Elsewhere in the economy, though, it was more head-scratching than celebrating because employment is still way down. Wages are and have been stuck for years. GDP growth is barely moving the needle. So what's all the hubbub, bub? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith got the assignment.
The party over Dow 16,000 seems a little strange because the economy hasn't given much cause for celebration to most of us this year.
I mean, we have seen a bit of a decoupling between the health of our economy and our stock market.
Alec Young is an equity strategist at S&P Capital IQ. He says the stock market reflects how much companies are making. But if people don't have jobs and spending is still sluggish, where are these profits coming from?
The companies are becoming more and more efficient, and that doesn't necessarily mean that they need to hire more and more Americans to do it.
U.S. companies have gotten leaner and meaner, says James Angel, a professor of finance at Georgetown. Here's the lean.
Look at General Motors. They went through bankruptcy court. They downsized dramatically, and now they're making money hand over fist.
And now for the mean. Angel says wages have stayed low, along with taxes and borrowing costs. 16,000 might be a new landmark for the Dow, but everyone should keep that in perspective, says Max Wolf, chief economist at ZT Wealth.
Part of the reason it's a record is because we just turned in one of the worst decades in equity performance in American history.
Wolf says markets are only up 10% over the last 5 years. Getting excited about 16,000 means grading on a big curve.
And this necessarily isn't the kind of curve you always see of the school for the gifted.
The U.S. economy has only grown about 2% this year. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
This next piece we're about to bring you has come to be known around these parts as a "the dog ate my homework" kind of story. Another tale of retailers blaming the latest weather pattern, blackout, congressional gridlock. I could go on, you know, for whatever bad news that they have to deliver. This time, it's the Affordable Care Act. Walmart says Obamacare could cut into sales by taking money out of its customers' pockets. Marketplace's Amy Scott looked into that one.
Starting in January, most of us will either need to have health insurance or pay a penalty. According to the Wall Street Journal, in a call with analysts last week, Walmart warned that's another, quote, line item in their personal budget that could cut into its customers' spending. Lynn Franco is an economist with the Conference Board.
Obviously, there's only so many discretionary dollars, and if there's fewer, consumers are going to have to make harder choices.
But isn't the Affordable Care Act supposed to save people money? A recent study by the Rand Corporation predicted out-of-pocket medical expenses will decline for most people who are newly insured or change their health plans. Then there are the almost 9 million more people who will be covered by Medicaid, says Josh Bivens with the Liberal Economic Policy Institute. Others will get subsidies to buy insurance.
In my mind, this is kind of like a delayed small stimulus program because it's actually providing people who are otherwise cash constrained to give them more income in the next couple of years.
Others say it's too soon to know how the healthcare law will play out. And analyst Joe Feldman, who follows Walmart for Telsey Advisory Group, says that uncertainty itself can weigh on shoppers.
If it's in the consumer's mind that they may have some pressure down the road, you may see them pull back on their spending.
So healthcare may be the new excuse du jour, as another analyst put it. As more retailers come out with their earnings forecasts in the next couple weeks, expect to hear more about it. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, Dow 16,000. You guys, what's not to love? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If there's one thing we've all learned the past 3 years, it's this. Healthcare gets really complicated really quickly. Here, though, is a part that's easy. Generic drugs are usually just as good as, but a whole lot cheaper than, big brand name drugs, which is why most health insurance providers force patients to go generic or pay through the nose. That is not, however, always the case when it comes to Medicare and its prescription drug plans, what are known as Part D. An investigation by ProPublica looked at more than 5 billion prescriptions and found Medicare is wasting hundreds of millions of dollars every year on brand names when generics would do, and that just 900 doctors accounted for more than $1 billion in that kind of spending. Amanda Aronchik reports.
In the southern part of Brooklyn, where the street names start heading towards the end of the alphabet, there's a surprisingly big medical complex on Avenue P.
As you see, this is our reception area.
It's the NYU Langone Levitt Medical Center.
We have 35,000 patients. It's like managing, from medical sense, a little city.
Dr. Susan Levitt runs this medical center. We've come here because there are 6 primary care doctors who prescribe brand name drugs far more often than their peers. Nationally, the ratio is almost 80% generic prescriptions to 20% for brand name drugs, whereas ProPublica found the 6 doctors here average closer to 50-50. These doctors wouldn't speak to us on tape, but Dr. Levitt would.
I always remind them to review the way how they prescribe, providing that it will not harm the patient.
Dr. Levitt says she does hold monthly quality assurance meetings, but that's where it ends. She doesn't monitor what her doctors prescribe. She herself sees patients, and almost half of her prescriptions were for brand name drugs. That's 50% higher than her peers, although not as high as the 6 other doctors. So we asked her, why?
They insist, and they insist, and they insist.
She says her patients, many of them immigrants, pressure her to get what they consider the top-notch brand-name drugs.
They don't understand. You can tell them 1,000 times, oh, my God. I mean, you can tell them whatever you want. And they say, no, we prefer la-la-la.
If it's a generic, they don't want it.
That's Roman Belyayev. He works at the one-stop pharmacy on the ground floor of this medical center. He speaks Russian, and so does Jacqueline Blishtin, the pharmacist. The shelves are stocked with little biscuits from Russia, and most of their customers are from the former Soviet Union.
Sometimes they'll say, well, we tried the generic and it doesn't work, or we have these side effects from the generic and the brand works completely different. I want the brand.
No, my favorite is actually my neighbor took the generic and landed in the hospital.
Which is unlikely, given that generics are required to have the same active ingredients as the brand. And even when there isn't an exact generic, there's usually something close. For most of the 36 million people in Medicare Part D, the choice between brand and generic is easy because the brand is more expensive. That's not the case for the 11 million people who qualify for the low-income subsidy.
What's that, this?
People like Emma. She moved here from the former Soviet Union 5 years ago, and she qualifies for a low-income subsidy, so her copay is roughly $6 for a brand-name drug and $3 for a generic. So when it comes to the Nexium she takes, she's all about the brand.
Nexium is stronger, but omeprazole is cheaper and not so strong.
Omeprazole, the generic Emma's talking about, works just as well as Nexium for many people. But based on a typical Part D plan, it costs about $7 a pill, where omeprazole is just 56 cents. In the end, it doesn't matter what Emma thinks, because it's the doctor who writes the prescription.
Even the patient may have a different opinion.
Again, Dr. Levitt.
But doctor is the final stage.
And depending on the doctor, there can be a huge impact on cost.
Those providers are not held accountable for prescription drug spending.
Dr. Nancy Morden is an associate professor at the Dartmouth Institute and has written about Medicare Part D drug spending. She says that in general, doctors don't think about price.
Physicians do not know the price of the drugs they prescribe and often do not know if a drug is available generically or only by brand name.
That hasn't been lost on the drug companies. They've sprinkled these doctors' offices with pens and calendars and pads of paper, creating an ever-present reminder of their products. And ProPublica found that of the heaviest prescribers of brand-name drugs, nearly half have received more than $1,000 from drug companies, usually through speaking fees or free meals.
There's no question in my mind that that influences prescribing practices. The pharmaceutical industry would not be investing billions of dollars each year and sending drug reps to the offices if it weren't effective.
So why doesn't Medicare push doctors to prescribe more generics? In a statement, a spokesperson said, "Medicare leaves doctors and patients free to make medical treatment decisions that are best for the patient." In New York, I'm Amanda Aronchik for Marketplace.
Amanda's story was produced for us in collaboration with WNYC and ProPublica, which made a tool so you can see what your doctor is prescribing for you. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up,
I would say we were prepared for the business side of it, and we were definitely prepared for the dangers of war. We were not prepared for the politics of it all.
Politics, profit, and private military contractors coming up. Eric Prince and Blackwater. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, that was anticlimactic, wasn't it? The Dow Industrials closed at 15,976, 24 points short of the big 1-6. Still up, though, 14 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ slid 36 points, 9/10%, finished at 39.49. The S&P 500 lost 6 points, about a 3%. Ended things at $17.91. Big airplanes cost big money, that we know. And we learned this weekend that oil-rich countries in the Gulf are willing to spend big money. At the Dubai Air Show, Boeing and Airbus announced deals of $140 billion worth of passenger jets. And thus, both stocks took off today. Boeing closed up 1 2/3%. EADS, EADS, the parent company of Airbus, reached an altitude nearly 2.5% higher today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.66%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Health discusses federal regulation of mobile medical apps. The Labor Department releases its latest employment cost index. And events at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania mark the 150th anniversary of President Lincoln's Gettysburg Address at the dedication of the Soldiers' National Cemetery. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Think about this the next time you see one of the great urban skylines in this country, New York or Chicago or San Francisco. Those views are the result primarily of two things, urban density and the zoning decisions that cities make, and something called air rights. Because in some places, up is the only way to build. And you can guess which direction that pushes prices. Sally Herships has more.
Hope you're not afraid of heights, because this story is all about tall buildings. We begin on the roof of Bob Shapiro's penthouse across the street from Central Park.
I'm 77 years old and I'm working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day.
Shapiro is an air rights broker. And here's where I have to do a little explaining. In New York, every building is zoned to be a certain height. If a building doesn't use its full allotment of vertical space, it can sell the rights to build upwards to another building. Those are called air rights. But the sale can only be made to a building's next-door neighbors. That's why some buildings are short and others are tall. Shapiro packages and sells those air rights, and he says he's so busy right now because the market for air is sizzling hot.
So is it easy to go in and buy these kinds of air rights? Is it expensive?
It's sort of like knocking on someone's door and telling them they won the lotto. It's sort of like money out of heaven.
Shapiro says the air up there can be worth tens of millions because in New York right now, the direction developers want to build is up. Like at the luxury residences at the W Hotel downtown in the Financial District, which is where I'm now riding an elevator up to the 53rd floor to check out the view through windows which are bigger than me.
It's amazing. Wow. Is that the Empire State Building?
That is the Empire State Building.
Derek Lee is a partner with LG Fairmont Group, a luxury real estate broker. He and Caroline Sabe, a marketing director with the W Residences, took me on a tour of a model condo in the building.
Well, we have very exciting bathrooms. They feature a crocodile tile on the floors and a snakeskin tile on the walls.
There are sub-zero refrigerators in the kitchen, and the gym and the spa are on the 31st floor. But the real star is the view. Starting on the 42nd floor, the price for one-bedroom apartments like these is around $1.5 million. And the higher you go in the building, the more you pay.
Absolutely. Like, the view changes everything.
Lee says new billionaires from developing countries are snapping up luxury condos and views like these. He says they want a safe place to park their cash and the status that comes with buying a pricey pad.
And you see it in the art market, too. You see pieces going for $250 million.
So, like, the apartment with the view is the new collectible.
Absolutely. It's a one-of-a-kind piece of art. And if you have it, no one else does.
Which brings us back to the air rights that makes these views possible. Prices right now are high, about $230 a square foot of air. Robert Van Anken is chairman of Landauer Valuation, a company that values air rights. He says today's high prices aren't a problem for developers selling luxury towers.
These air rights were purchased many years ago, and so the developers were able to save money.
Landauer says back in 2006, a square foot of air went for about $100 less. Developers can spend years packaging enough rights together to build one of these towers. Remember, you can only buy air rights from your neighbor. But once you do, the rest of the deals come easier.
They would come to one property owner and say, nobody's ever going to buy your air rights except me.
Another selling point, sales of air rights come with a perk. Bob Shapiro, the broker, says the sales qualify for what's called a 1031 exchange, also known as a tax break.
And you could use the money that you got from the air rights to buy another building.
Tax-free. No.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
But even though prices are high in cities like New York, dirt is still worth more than air. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The big mover in the markets today wasn't reflected in any stock index or bond yield, because how old school is that? Bitcoin, the virtual currency, hit $750. Today, back in July, a single Bitcoin could be had for less than $80. Bitcoin is a favorite of speculators and schemers, which is why the Senate Committee on Homeland Security held a hearing today to talk about its risks and its rewards. We asked Marketplace's David Weinberg to find out for us whether, or maybe when, Bitcoins might become part of our everyday spending lives.
Right now, very few businesses accept Bitcoins. There's a Subway sandwich shop in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and in some cities you can have a pizza delivered. But that transaction has to go through this guy.
What am I, 25 years old? My friend's 25 as well.
Riley Alexander and a friend founded Pizza for Coins. It's basically a middleman between large chains like Domino's and Papa John's, which don't accept Bitcoins, and customers who want to pay with Bitcoins. Alexander says they've handled about 800 deliveries since February, and they make a small amount on each one.
Anywhere from 50 cents to, you know, $3, $4, $5.
But then, to his surprise, Alexander and his friend watched as speculation drove the value of their Bitcoins up.
That small amount of profit turned into large amounts of profit, you know, over time.
But that rapid rise in value, it's not necessarily great news for Bitcoin.
The value of it has to become much more stable than it is now.
Francois Valdi is an economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. He says that one of the prerequisites for any widely accepted currency is that it has stability.
There's a bit of a chicken and egg problem here. As long as people speculate on it, the value will not stabilize.
And yet, much of this speculation is built on the hopes that Bitcoin will become widely accepted and deliver on its promises, such as transactions that eliminate the middleman, like Riley Alexander.
If Domino's comes up and says, hey, we're going to take Bitcoin, sure, our business is over, but that's great. I would love to see that.
I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
When this country goes to war, the Pentagon doesn't do it alone. Private military contractors play a big part. They have for centuries. In Iraq and Afghanistan, there was no contractor more notorious than Blackwater, in particular for the 2007 shootings in Baghdad's Nisour Square, where Blackwater employees on a State Department security detail were accused of killing 17 Iraqis. Eric Prince is the founder and former CEO of Blackwater. His new book about his company and its time in Iraq and Afghanistan is called Civilian Warriors. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
This is fundamentally a book about the business of war, and clearly the war part you were prepared for. I wonder if you were prepared, though, for the business part of what you got yourself into.
I would say we were prepared for the business side of it, and we were definitely prepared for the dangers of war. We were not prepared for the politics of it all.
Let me do this. Let me read you back to yourself, and I want to ask you a question about this thing you wrote. We're on page 4, actually, pretty early in the book, and you say, "The business of war has never been pretty, but I did my job legally, and I did it completely. Too well, perhaps, growing Blackwater until it became something resembling its own branch of the military and other government agencies." I wonder if that's pretty much your whole problem in a nutshell right there, that the public perceived you as an independent military force in a very volatile place without much recourse to accountability.
Well, it's inaccurate. Yes, we had a lot of capability. We grew. You know, when I had a colonel come up to me after speaking at the War College and say, you know, he had just come back from brigade command in Baghdad, so he had 3,000 to 4,000 people working for him. And he said in the top of their dashboards were the Blackwater call signs. And they knew if things went bad, the Blackwater guys would come for them when they called.
Yeah, I'm not.
I wish we'd been doing diplomatic security in Benghazi. I can tell you that Benghazi would not have happened if Blackwater were on the job there.
Tell you what, let's stay actually where you were on the ground. And I'm not disputing the fact that the military came to rely on you and that the State Department came to rely on you. But I'm asking you this perception question. In the eyes of the American public, did it perhaps happen that you guys became a negative because of how you were perceived? It's a brand question, right? The Blackwater brand. You talk about this a lot in this book.
Sure. If it's just a matter of branding, you know, look, we were slimed along the way by trial lawyers. We were slimed along the way by a press that was tired of the Bush / Iraq war. And, you know, being armed people that were protecting diplomats was a very easy target for them.
You are clearly unhappy with how you and the company have been treated in the days since Nisour Square in Baghdad and certainly since 2010 when you actively left the company. My question then is, if we are going to have private military contractors, which, as you point out, we have had in this country for hundreds of years, how would you like them to be treated? How should they be held accountable? How should they be disciplined? How should they be regulated? How should they act?
Have the contractors abide by the contracts and the government abide by the contracts that they sign up to. It's a two-way street, not a one-way street.
And then when things go very, very wrong, as they did in Nisour Square in Baghdad in 2007 when 17 Iraquis died, what happens?
Well, again, you know, there was 11 Iraquis that died.
Okay. I stand corrected. But loss of life is loss of civilian life. What is supposed to happen then?
Well, first of all, we support due process for anyone that's accused. And, you know, speedy trials, not a prolonged six-year Office of Circumlocution from the Department of Justice. Any innocent loss of life is tragic. And we're truly sorry for that. But, you know, employing thousands of people, unfortunately, even a turbine engine breaks, and a turbine engine only has 3 or 4 moving parts.
I wonder if you realized back then when you were signing these contracts, and even if you realize now, that when the CIA, when the Pentagon, when the Department of State signed these contracts with you, what they were effectively doing to some degree was outsourcing their political risks so that when things happened like Nisour Square, they could say, whoa, wait, this was the contractors, man.
Well, they're not doing it to outsource their political risk. They're doing it because they truly don't have the manpower or the logistics capability to fulfill those missions. So really the company becomes like a very robust temp agency, operating very much under the command and control of the government.
You have written or said, I can't actually remember if it's in this book or if it's in a quote that I read of yours somewhere, you wanted Blackwater to be to the Pentagon as FedEx is to the U.S. Postal Service.
I did say that, and I agree with that. I think in this era of ridiculously high defense and intelligence budgets, we as a taxpayer could get a lot better value if there's more private benchmarks for how much some of these things should cost. And there's plenty of room to cut the defense budget. And I think
you're not making yourself any friends in Washington when you say that. I guess you don't have any friends in Washington.
That's not something I'm really worried about right now.
Yeah.
But, you know, I want to take it away. I want to take away the notion that it's unpatriotic to cut the defense budget. I love the U.S. military. I want them to be the most effective and the most cost effective. And I think there is so much spending and so much bloat and so much bureaucracy that it actually hinders them from having a lot of the mission accomplishments that they should.
Eric Prince founded and for many years ran Blackwater Incorporated. His new book is called Civilian Warriors, the inside story of Blackwater and the unsung heroes of the war on terror. Eric, thanks very much for your time.
You bet. Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which comes to us from the pages of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. The paper reports that a Walmart in Canton, Ohio, is hosting a food drive for its own employees. Photos of the tables, we should say, are being shared by a pro-union group of Walmart employees. Company spokesperson said the drive is evidence that Walmart workers rally around each other in times of need. And we need to go. That is Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.